I, like you, have great concerns about where we are in our culture. And I think one of the greatest things that concerns me is not just how elections turn out and who's in charge of what. That's all important, obviously. But I think the greatest problem that we're facing is a crisis of truth. It's just a crisis of truth. What is truth? You know, Pilate one time asked Jesus, what is truth? So we live in a culture where we seem incapable of discerning between the truth. For instance, here's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and this is a direct quote. She said just a couple of years ago, I think that there's a lot of people more concerned about being precisely, factually, and semantically correct than about being morally right. Now, I want you to think about that for just a moment. That's an oxymoron. That's also a Washington moron, but that is an oxymoron. Think about it. There are a lot of people that are more concerned about being precisely, factually, and semantically correct than about being morally right. So she is suggesting that something could be morally right, but not factually and semantically correct. That's the end result. This is the product of people who've been taught that how you feel about something is more important than the facts. And this is the culture that we're living in today. This is the battle that we fight. Now, this is a columnist for the New York Times, Kevin Roos. He called just a few days ago four accurate articles right-wing misinformation. These articles were about the fraud that occurred during the election on the 3rd. When he was called out, he admitted that the articles were factually accurate, but says they were still misinformation. Now, here's his quote. For the conservatives who are mad about this, now what he's referring to here is the fact that he said that even though the stories are true, they're misinformation. So he's saying, if I've offended you conservatives, yes, it is possible for a story to be factually accurate and for it to be part of a misinformation campaign aimed at undermining confidence in an election. Now, here's what he's saying. He's saying the same thing that Cortez said in that previous quote. This one is just recent. He's saying that it is possible to tell the truth, but to undermine a bunch of cheaters. That's what he's saying. He's saying that that's misinformation. Now, if your head's spinning just a little bit right now, join the club, because mine is too. This is the world we live in today. This is why preachers like Andy Stanley can say we need to unhitch from the Old Testament. Do you realize what that does to Christendom and to theology if you burn the Old Testament? Even though Jesus said, search the scriptures, for in them you'll find me. When he says Moses was writing about me. When he was witnessing to the disciples on the road to Emmaus, the Bible says he reasoned out of the scriptures about himself. Well, you realize that in Jesus' day, the scriptures were the Old Testament. But see, we live in a crazy world where theologians are just as circular in their reasoning as AOC or the reporter named Roos. So this is the world in which we live. And whether we like it or not, that's the challenge. That's where we are. Now, this message that I'm going to deliver today was actually intended to be a part two to the message on November the 1st. Now, Paul was up to preach today, but he called me this week and said, Dan, they've thrown this thing at me in Georgia, and would you be willing to preach today? Because I'm working hard trying to put this together, and I can tell you, it's a ton of work that Paul does to make these things happen. Each of us kind of have our own tasks. My job is to get down there and bring the equipment and AV and all that kind of stuff and set it up and then do black robe and speak a couple of other times. But one of the things that he does is all of the scheduling and the coordination and putting all of it together, and then Sue and Dan and others step in and help carry it out. And so he said, would you speak today? Now, I didn't plan on that, but this was the message that I intended 3 weeks ago to be part two of the message that I preached on November the 1st, the Sunday before the election. So for some reason, it appears to me that this is the message God wanted us to hear today. So in one of those rare occasions, Paul heard from God, did the right thing. I'm going to stop right there. That's all. I'm not going to do anymore. Although just as soon as you get the mic, you'll start it up again. I know what you'll do. So I want to preach a message entitled Lights in the Dark and Salt in the Wound. Now this is a topic that I'm sure you've heard preached on many, many times. I'm not so sure that you'll hear anything new today. But what I hope that you will hear is a clear message from God that we still have work to do. One of the most often asked questions that I'm receiving these days is, Dan, do you think that Trump can pull it out? Well, obviously, it's not all that much left up to Trump any longer. It's left up to attorneys and hopefully just justices. Thus, they're called justices, courts, and who knows how that's going to turn out. I think it's obvious there was a whole lot of cheating, a lot of fraud, but who knows how that's going to go. We could very well be seeing on January the 20th, President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris. I mean, I don't know that that's what's going to happen, but we could very well be seeing that. If things do not go right in early January in Georgia, we could see the Democrat Party not only have very slight, but still a majority in the House, but they would also have a slight majority in the Senate. Do you realize then that opens the door for all of it? That opens up the door for the new Green Deal. That opens up the door for packing the Supreme Court. That means put as many justices on it as you have to until you dominate it and the other side doesn't have a prayer. And primarily the Constitution doesn't have a prayer. That may spell the addition of at least two new left-leaning states, guaranteeing the leftists a majority in Congress in perpetuity. Because you realize what's at stake here. So what do we do? I mean, people are asking me, Dan, what do you do? What do I do? I'm asking myself, God, what do I do? Well, God's given us the marching orders. As you've heard me say many times, you've heard Paul say it, heaven is not alarmed. God is not scratching his head. The command and the mission that he gave us centuries ago still stands. We have a job to do. God never promised us that it would be easy. God never promised us that we would experience success in the way in which we define success. If you look at a large number of Christians who've lived since the day of Pentecost, you will discover what you already, of course, know, that there are many Christians who've paid dearly for the privileges that we've enjoyed most of our lives. Many have died for nothing more than standing for Christ. There will be, on the average, the Voice of the Martyrs, a ministry headquartered up around Bartlesville here in Oklahoma. There will be, on the average today, 400 Christians who will die for their faith around the world today. Today. We lose sight of that sometimes, don't we? Because we see our storm, we see what we're involved in. That's got to be the most important thing on God's mind, is it? How about those 400 Christians that will die today for no other reason than they're a Christian? Read the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews. We've referred to it numerous times over the last few weeks. You'll read about Christians that ultimately the Bible doesn't name, but it says the world was not worthy of them. And yet they endured hardships we can't even imagine. Today in America, we have been made scaredy cats by a disease that's not much different than other diseases we've faced in the past. It's real. We all know that. We've admitted that. But my goodness, have we become soft? Have we lost our courage? Churches are closed up. Churches are suspending ministries. And granted, no one wants COVID-19. But what about all of those that faced Spanish flu in my great-grandmother's era? I think I've mentioned it before, when she came home from the cemetery after burying one child who was sick with Spanish flu, not to know whether or not the other child had died. How would you like that? Did they quit? Did the church quit then? Did Christians just roll up in a fetal position and say, that's enough? A lot of people listen to what guys like Paul and I say, and unfortunately there's not near enough of us. And they'll say, well, all Blair and Fisher care about is government. They're just all about politics. Well, you know that's not true. We had literally hundreds and hundreds of views of last Sunday's pastor's class where Paul and I just kind of got honest with you about where we are in all of this and how to make sense out of it. And yet there are always those who will come on and criticize. And one particular person said, hey, how about dropping all the politics and talking about, let's say, maybe the Old Testament? Well, that's great. And if you'll go online, I just finished a series where I taught through the first 11 chapters of Genesis in the Old Testament. The assumption that that's all we talk about. Well, that is not all we talk about. You know that. And today's message will be a prime example. Carl Henry was a great Christian leader in the 20th century. And he was one of these preachers who realized that we better start to engage the culture or we're going to lose the culture. He was instrumental in starting things like the National Association of Evangelicals. He actually started the magazine that is known today as Christianity Today. And I want you to listen to what he said. He said, we failed to focus sharply on the indispensable role of government in preserving justice in a fallen society. Essential as regenerative forces are to transform the human will, civil government remains nonetheless a necessary instrument to constrain human beings, whatever their religious predilections, to act justly whether they desire to do so or not. Now what he's saying in a nutshell is, we haven't forgotten our call to preach the gospel. We're not undervaluing the importance of somebody being made right with God. But we also, while we're doing that, cannot forget that government is one of the institutions that God designed to keep fallen man from killing each other without limits. To keep fallen man from stealing from one another without limits, or you just extrapolate it. This is why these things are so important. I didn't run for the legislature because I had some kind of crazy idea that I could find some kind of new career as a politician. Last thing in the world I want to be is a politician. That's why I didn't do so well down at the legislature. I refused to be a politician. But I believe that my call from God was to be light in the dark and salt in the wound. And that's my job. That's what I'm called to do. And whatever best way I can do that, whatever best way you can do that, is what we're supposed to be doing in this world. It all boils down to this. How do you see the world? What is your view of the world? What pair of glasses do you look through? What contact lenses cover your eyes? What kind of a worldview do you have? How do you interpret what's right and wrong? If you follow people like AOC and Kevin Roos, you'll argue that something that's factual may not really be important, and that which is a fraud should be held up as the standard. It's all upside down. God has warned us, woe to those who call good bad and bad good. And yet that's the world we live in. Francis Schaeffer was warning us about this back in the middle of the 20th century. He was warning us that the American church and the American Republic was on a course that was going to bring us into a head-on collision with anarchy and Marxism. In his A Christian Manifesto, listen to what he said. What we must understand is that the two worldviews really bring forth with inevitable certainty, not only personal differences, but total differences in regard to society, government, and law. There is no way to mix these two total worldviews. They are separate entities that cannot be synthesized. It is not too strong to say that we are at war, and there are no neutral parties in the struggle. One either confesses that God is the final authority, or one confesses that Caesar is Lord. He's right. You cannot coexist. He said, we have reached a place today in which it is violently opposed to what the founding fathers of this country and those in the 13 individual states had in mind when they came together and formed the Union. It is time to think the bottom line as our forefathers did. When any office commands that which is contrary to the word of God, those who hold that office abrogate their authority and they are not to be obeyed. And that includes the state. The bottom line is that at a certain point, there is not only the right, but the duty to disobey the state. And what he's trying to tell us here is that you cannot separate your spiritual view of the world from your political, i.e. social view of the world. Your worldview will determine everything that you believe about everything. You cannot separate and say, well, you know, I've got a Christian worldview of this, but I kind of have a secular worldview of this area. It's impossible. You cannot do it. Paul shares at our conferences a sermon on compartmentalization and how Christians have compartmentalized their lives these days into the sacred and the secular. We can't do it. So here's the familiar passage. Matthew 5, 13 through 16. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor or savor, how shall it be seasoned or salted? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Elihu Burritt was a 19th century author, American diplomat, as you can see, philanthropist and social activist. I want you to listen to what he said. No human being can come into this world without increasing or diminishing the sum total of human happiness. Not only of the present, but of every subsequent age of humanity. I want you to listen to that quote. Think on it for just a moment. A lot of times I fear that I throw these quotes up here, you kind of read through it real quickly and you move on. Listen to what he's saying. Every one of us will either increase or diminish the goodness in this world, not only in our generation, but in generations to follow. Don't ever buy the idea that your life doesn't make any difference. Your life, for the people whose lives will be touched by the ripples that your life sends into time and eternity, will be definitely touched, either for the good or for the bad. Even as Christians. John MacArthur summarizes it like this. The Lord summarizes the function of believers in the world, reduced to one word, that function is influence. Now that's what Jesus is talking about when he's talking about this idea of being salt and light. Richard Land, who used to be a major voice within the Southern Baptist Convention for religious liberty and interface of Christianity and government, said this in an article, being salt and light in an unsavory and dark age, the Christian and politics. Our nation is quickly losing the ability to espouse universal moral values or to insist that such standards define socially acceptable and affirmed behavior. In other words, we can't tell the difference between protesters and rioters. The result is a vapid culture in rapid decay, where behavior that was considered reprehensible just a couple of decades ago is now allowed and even applauded in many culture-defining venues. What happened in Chaz was considered to be patriotism. You mean seizing control of the local government and locking down a city block? And stealing other people's property, and in the process, injuring and murdering some is patriotism. We can't tell the difference. He says the populace is rapidly losing its moral bearings, and it has either rejected Christianity and its moral norms outright, denied its relevance, or relegated it to the level of a self-help regimen. The religion which dominated in President Adams' time has for too many been replaced by a faith in which man is the chief beneficiary. How many times do you hear people say, well, I go to this church because it does this, this, and this for me? God is invoked for the benefit of the religious. What he desires of people is secondary at best. For many other Americans, yet further adrift on the seas of moral relativism, a holy trinity of narcissism has emerged. I, myself, and me. That's the trinity today that we worship. Me, myself, and I. We're not worried about what God wants. So as Christians, how do we synthesize all of this? What do we do if things do not turn out the way we want and there is a regime or a government change, a leadership change in early January? What do we do if the elections in Georgia don't go the way that we believe they should? What do we do? The same thing we ought to be doing today. In the end, this is not our home. We love it. We love the republic. We love liberty. We love justice. But the Bible warns us over and over and over that there will not always be justice on this earth. There will not always be liberty. There will be times of tyranny. There will be times of injustice. Our lives may not be more comfortable in the coming years and decades. I hope that's not true, but they may not be. So what do? Do we just throw up our hands and quit? Does the church just sit around and moan and groan about what could have been, what should have been, but wasn't? So what do? It's simple. Jesus said, be salt. Be light. Why salt? Have you ever wondered? You've probably heard this before, but if you haven't, I think it helps to understand. Jesus uses many names for us throughout his ministry. Some of them are not complimentary. Like when he calls us sheep. I mean, we think of little baby lambs, right? Well, I don't think that's what he was thinking of. I think he was thinking of adult sheep that are so stupid that they'll keep eating grass and not notice where they are and walk off a bluff. I think he was thinking of adult sheep that if the shepherd doesn't shear their wool, their hair will grow down over their face. They can't even see. I think he was thinking of sheep that if they get over on their sides and become what shepherds call cast, they can't get up. So I've fallen and can't get up. And they will lie there and die. I think that's what he was thinking about. I think he was thinking about some adult sheep, especially ewes, who will get outside the fence where they're not supposed to be, where the predators can get them, and then will lead other younger ones astray. I think that's what he was thinking about. If you've never read Philip Keller's book, not to be confused with Tim Keller, Philip Keller, a book entitled A Shepherd Looks at the 23rd Psalm, you need to get it. Guarantee you can go on Amazon and buy a used copy for almost nothing. He takes the experience of being a shepherd himself and then takes Jesus' teaching and Psalm 23's teaching on sheep and shepherds, and man, does it open up a whole new world to you. So why does Jesus call us salt? Well, you understand that salt really should be poison. It should be poisonous. It's a compound made up of two poisons. Sodium, that's poisonous. Sodium is not good for you. Added to it is chloride. Chloride is a poison. So if you add sodium to chloride, it just figures you ought to get a poison, right? But in the miracle of God's economy and in the miracle of God's creation, God takes two poisons, combines them together into a compound, and what was poisonous can become life sustaining, and life-giving. Not a poison if used properly. Well, salt has at least three effects on the world around it. You already know all of these. One, it slows decay. Now, that's not much of a deal for us anymore with modern refrigeration and freezers and refrigerators. We don't have to worry about it too much. But my grandmother's generation did. My grandmother once said, "Dan, can you imagine the world that I've seen in my lifetime? From riding in the back of a horse pull wagon to town on Saturdays, it would take us hours to get there. We'd do all of our stuff in town, then it would take us hours to get back home." And she said, "I sat there and watched Neil Armstrong walk on the moon." Whew, that's a quantum leap, isn't it? Salt will slow decay. What is Jesus saying to you? What is he saying to me? I am a retardant agent in this culture. My job is to do what God has called me to do as a believer, and by doing that, I retard the decay that's going on around me. Or, as Burritt said, I increase the rate of decay if I don't do my job. Secondly, salt seasons food. You know that. It makes that which is typically bland more tasty. I like a lot of salt more than most, because for me, it brings it to life. What is Jesus saying to you? What is Jesus saying to me about my call? He's saying, "Dan, wherever you are, you ought to be seasoning the culture. Not just retarding the decay by doing what is right and standing for what is right, but you ought to be bringing flavor. People ought to walk away from you saying, 'Wow, I like being around them. Man, they add something to the room.'" Do you know people that when they walk into the room, all the oxygen leaves? And yet they think that they're doing God's work. You and I should season this world. We live in a decaying culture that doesn't smell or taste good. And one of the things that salt can do besides retarding that decay is salt can season it and make life a little bit better for people, not worse. Now, how do we do that? Well, for one thing, you don't walk around telling everybody the sky is falling. You don't walk around and say, "Well, it's up, it's over." As if all of our hopes were in a re-election of a conservative for president. Friends, you and I have the ability, by God's grace, to make life taste a little better to those around us. If we will, but we cannot do that, even though all of these things matter, by just throwing in the towel and all we can talk about is doomsday. My job, your job, is to make things a little better than what they are. And then, of course, last, salt stings in a wound. I had a preacher tell me years ago when I was just a young preacher, he said, "Dan, your job is very simple. Comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable." That's your job. That's your job. Our job is to be a reminder that this world is wounded. And we ought to be a sting in that wound. You ought to always be a reminder to people, they're going to have to answer for that. You're not going to get away with this. That's not right. There's a better way. You're going to die someday, and then the judgment. Now, we don't want to just hammer them in the head with it all the time, but we need to be a reminder, and we need to be a sting in that wound, and they need to be reminded that they're wounded so that they can come to know the one who was wounded for their transgressions. Amen. Who was bruised for their iniquities. The chastisement of God the Father, instead of falling on them, fell on him. So that's why salt. In Matthew 5, it's interesting, Jesus does not suggest that his followers be salt. He does not make it optional. He boldly declares, "We are salt." In his commentary on the book of Matthew, Frederick Bruner declares it like this. Christians are, by the simple fact that they are with Jesus, the salt of the earth. The Christian ethic is an ethic of become what you are, rather than the Greek or Confucian ethic of become what you should be. That subtle difference is the difference. How often do you hear people say, well, I know I ought to. No. No, if you're in Christ, you are. And if you're not, if I'm not, then I'm going to account for it. It's not I should be, I am. You are the salt of the earth. Now, you may not be doing your proper function for which you will answer to God even as a Christian, but you are the salt. Not you ought to become the salt, you are the salt. Now then, very quickly, why light? Well, it ought to be obvious to us. 2 Corinthians 4:4 says that Satan, who is the god of this world, has blinded those who live in darkness. In John chapter 1, the Bible says, in Jesus was life, and the life was the light of men. He shined that light into the darkness when he came. Ephesians 5:8, Paul says, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. 1 Thessalonians 5:5, Paul once again says, you are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Now you can take that two ways. I think one way is we shouldn't be messing around with darkness. We shouldn't be compromising, excuse me, in our own lives. That's one truth. But the other truth is we shouldn't be carrying around darkness and sharing it with everybody else. We shouldn't walk into a room where there's very little light to begin with and then bless them with more darkness. We should walk into a room and they should say, he, she has something I don't have. They have a hope that I don't have. They have light that I don't see. And you ought to walk into a room and the place ought to be lighter and brighter. Not because you're brilliant, not because I'm brilliant, but because Christ, who is the light of the world, lives in me. And he cannot help but shine. So when you walk into a room, do you season it? Is there a little sting in the wound? Do you slow down the decay? But when you walk into a room, is there more or less light when you leave? Light produces at least three effects. You know it. It reduces darkness. Just like salt retards decay, light reduces darkness. And it doesn't take much. We all found that out just a few days ago when the electricity went off, right? I mean, it doesn't take a very bright light to make a really big difference when there is no light. I mean, just a little bitty candle, a little bitty flashlight, a little bitty lantern, which otherwise would almost be useless to us, becomes almost invaluable at a time like this. You remember the movie The Christmas Story? We all watch it every year at Christmas time. You remember when they plug in too many lights on the tree and the sparks go everywhere? It reminds me of my childhood growing up. It's exactly what we did. We'd plug stuff in more directions than you can possibly imagine into one of those couplers. And then finally, we'd blow a fuse. Of course, today you trip a breaker, but those days you'd blow a fuse. And you remember when it goes pitch black and he says, nobody move. And then he's able to fix that blown fuse. We reduce the darkness. You and I should be doing the work that nobody else can do. And even if we're not a big light, it doesn't matter. In a dark room, it's a whole lot of light. In fact, you just can't ignore the light. No matter how small it is, you just can't ignore it. Have you ever gone to bed in a room and you find out that there's some stupid little red or blue light that is on some gadget? That thing becomes a lighthouse. If you're packing, you want to shoot it out. Right? But light also reveals wickedness. It doesn't just reduce the darkness, but it puts a light on that which is evil. Don't have time this morning, but John 3, Jesus said, that's the reason why wicked people stay away from the light. Because the light reveals their wicked deeds. So they hide like roaches. The light reveals wickedness. That's what we ought to be doing. And I don't mean like we're always pointing a finger at somebody, being judgmental towards someone. It doesn't mean that you don't make judgments. We're called to make judgments. We're just not called to be judgmental. But we're to be shining the light, speaking the truth, especially now. We do not retreat. We move forward. God's kingdom is always forward, never retreat. And third, it rescues the seekers, doesn't it? There's a movie called Finest Hours. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's the story of a lifeboat team that goes out and saves these guys that are on an oil tanker that's broken in half back in the 50s. It's an amazing story if you've never seen it. And what's really neat about it is that they're trying with everything they can out in that ocean to find that broken piece of that ship. And any light at all will allow them to rescue those who are lost at sea. But then once they load up the lifeboat, they turn around to head back and the electricity's out. And they can't find the shore. They can't find home until finally someone has the bright idea, turn the headlights on the cars. And they begin to turn those headlights on, shining through that snow and that fog. But the least little bit of light will lead the lost at sea home. Friend, you and I are to be the beacon that leads them to the one who can answer their questions and solve their problems. Believers are not a candle waiting to be lit. Just like we are the salt, we are the light. Jesus doesn't say, I hope that someday you will become the light. He says, you are the light. So how do I wrap this up? Well, in Philippians 2:15, Paul says this, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. So I'm salt. I'm light. And my job is to season and light this culture, no matter what happens. That's my job. And that mission has never changed. You know, there's an old saying that says, he's not worth his salt. A lot of people debate as to where that comes from. Some say, well, it used to be in the days when Roman soldiers were paid rather with money than with salt. But it actually comes from the word salarium, and it's where we get our word salary. In fact, S-A-L is Latin for salt. And regardless of whether people were paid in salt or they were paid in gold or silver, they used that salary to purchase salt. Now we think of today salt, well, it's everywhere, right? Well, that's not always been true. There's been times when salt was practically as valuable as gold. Your salt. Are you worth your salt? Are you worth what God has invested in you? Light. Well, it's like the old saying goes, you never miss the water till the well runs dry, right? Well, you never miss the light till the lights go out. And then all of a sudden, any light is valuable. You're the light in a dark world. So God has called us, friends. It doesn't matter what happens. I mean, it does matter. We all want the right thing. But in the end, my mission doesn't change. I'm to be salt and light. You are salt and light. John Adams said something that I think we ought to hear here at the close. He says, while our country remains untainted with the principles and manners which are now producing desolation in so many parts of the world, while she continues sincere and incapable of insidious and impious policy, we shall have the strongest reason to rejoice in the local destination assigned us by Providence. In short, as long as we do right, we don't have to worry about the future. But, he says, should the people of America once become capable of that deep simulation towards one another and towards foreign nations, which assumes the language of justice and moderation while it is practicing iniquity and extravagance and displays in the most captivating manner the charming pictures of candor, frankness, and sincerity, while it is rioting in rapine and insolence, this country will be the most miserable habitation in the world. Because we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Friend, it's not the government we're counting on. It's the salt and the light. You, me. I want to close this story. I can't remember if I've told it here or not. It was a man who was otherwise a pretty good guy. He was a big guy. But when he would drink, he would become violent. And in England, where he lived, one particular night, he got really drunk and he got into a fist fight. Because he was so big, he beat this guy to death. Well, everybody in the community knew that otherwise he's a good man. But he had to be punished. And so they had his trial. The judge couldn't bring to sentence him to death, but here's what he did do. He sentenced him with a very strange penalty. The penalty was that the initials of the man that he had murdered would be branded in his forehead. So that every day when he looked into the mirror, he would see those initials and be reminded of the man whose life he took in a moment of drunken stupor and rage. So they branded the letters G.M. into this man's forehead. For the rest of his life, everywhere he went, there were these letters, G.M. One day there were a couple of boys sitting on a board fence beside a road. They were just talking like boys do, and here came this man up the road walking. And one of the boys, who apparently had never seen him, kind of glanced at him and then stopped and looked again. And he punched his buddy in the ribs and he said, "Look at that! Look at that, what is that?" As the man got closer, he said, "Those are letters. That man has letters burned into his forehead. G.M. I wonder what that stands for." And his buddy said, "You know, I don't know. I've never asked him. But that man teaches my Sunday school class every Sunday. And he's taught me about the love of God. I've just assumed it must stand for God's man." When the world sees you, do they see salt and light? Do they see God's man? God's woman?